Hi everyone, welcome to All Things Creative, or Art Chat as I like to call them. Today we have movie producer Dick Atkins with us, and Dick's an old friend. Met him up in, oh gosh, Ohio. Was it Akron? I can't remember exactly
what
it was.
In Youngstown.
Youngstown, yes, yeah, yes. I knew the Butler Institute. I was thinking Butler Institute, but
that's
I can't
right.
remember what city.
Yeah.
And no, I won't say that. I'll insult everybody in Ohio. But anyway, yeah, so I asked Dick to come back on the show to talk about movie producing and basically talking about how the whole process works from having a script all the way to releasing it to films. And Dick can tell you a little bit about his background here in a second. So hang on. One of the reasons why I asked Dick to do this was because I had taken a kind of introductory course, if you will, from a media company, which will remain nameless, that, you know, was boasting about this whole process of having a script and getting it to the finished product of film. And when I started to do some of the analysis, everything that they were talking about sounded wonderful until you looked at the numbers, and until I talked with my friend Dick and with my friend George Mello. And then, you know, you kind of sat there and figured out that there's this whole area called development, which I think I kind of refer to now as development hell. But
You and everybody else.
Exactly. So what I wanted to do was basically have Dick come on the show and talk about the whole process, and with the caveat of Dick is a movie producer. So, you know, we're not going to get into the real nitty gritty pieces of how do you write a script or things like that, or what a pitch should look like or anything like that. But we just want to talk about the full process so that people can be a little more informed and understand that, you know, there are probably what, Dick, millions of scripts out there and a small percentage gets to film.
Understatement on both counts.
Okay, well, there we go. So let's start back with, you know, I'm a screenwriter, I'm a script writer, I am a novel writer, whatever, and I have a great idea. What happens at that point? Nothing?
Well,
the majority of time?
listen, I have faced the same thing. I have written two, and I've written a couple of things that I produced myself, and I've done a lot of rewriting of other writers on the things that I've produced. So I've sat in that chair too, and I still do. Even of things that I've written, you know, a few passion projects, whatever, or I may have written up the original proposal for a project, or an outline, and you sit there and you say, now what do I do?
Right.
How do I get this thing going? And of course, if there were an easy answer, everybody'd be doing it. Exactly. So of course there is no easy answer to it. The first plus is that in writing, unlike in acting, say, directing, sort of a middle ground now, but in other disciplines in the business, you can do it on your own. Nobody is stopping you from sitting down and writing a script. And as long as you've taken the time to learn as much as you can how to do it. I know, for instance, Linda, you teach painting, you teach writing, you teach, you know, all these disciplines. You need to know at least the form that you're dealing in.
Right.
And dealing in a script is not dealing in a novel. It's not dealing in a play. It has its own form. And as long as you're familiar with that form, and if you want to break the rules, go ahead. As long as you know what the general structural rules are,
right?
Then great. Then nobody's stopping you. So that's terrific. That's a plus. And I'll tell you why it's especially a plus now, because development, which you started talking about before, has gotten more and more difficult. Development hell is an old-time industry
term,
which basically, if people are wondering, refers to when you...
Oh, gosh.
Um, let me get my train of thought back.
Yeah, okay.
after my dad tries to call me for 100 times a day.
Oh,
oh my goodness.
We'll forgive him. I know.
No. That development has become so difficult because when we talk about development in the movie business or the TV business, basically what we're talking about is after you've sold your idea. You know, you can use the development as a wide term. Sure, a production company may be having a writer write up something or whatever, and they call that development and whatnot. Mm-hmm. The development hell that we talk about is after you sold your idea. Ah. After somebody's being paid to actually write the script. And the script gets done, and then no one can decide what to do with it. That they don't put it into production. They endlessly ask for rewrites, changes, God knows what. And it just sits there month on month on month, year on year on year. That's development hell. You just get caught up in this and you don't know what to do. You don't know how to, you know, wrest it away from them or get them to move or anything. And you're stuck. And that's kind of where that the hell reference comes from.
Yeah.
So it's nice to avoid that at all costs. And the other side of it is that the studios and networks and streaming services and all of these places now don't really love that situation anymore either.
Right.
So and the big turning point was the writer's strike. Whatever it is now ago, you know, 8 years ago, whatever it was. And that right after that writer's strike, the studios very much turned away from development deals, from paying people to write scripts unless they knew you already.
Yeah.
You know, unless you're a big time writer who you know, you're out having coffee with the studio executive, you're out at your kid's little league game, and you say, I got this great idea. He says, okay, let me pay you to write it. Well, that isn't going to happen to you or me. So what they want now is a finished product. They want you to go ahead and write it. They want to see it without paying for it. Mm. And pretty much the same thing for if you're talking in a movie sense, say, for the streaming services and whatnot, where you'll see most development still is on the TV network basis. For NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox, the broadcast networks, and a lot of the cable networks, you, relatively established writers, unless a big agent or producer is walking you in the door, can walk in the door and say, here's my idea, here's my pitch, this would make a great series, and I'd like to write it. And you can go into development there, and they'll pay you or whatever writer they approve to go ahead and write that script. And then you'll sit a little bit in hell waiting for them to decide whether to shoot a pilot or not, you know, and then when they make the pilot, whether you get to be one of the pilots chosen to go to series or not, and on from that.
Right.
That can be a tremendously frustrating experience also. And George, who you mentioned before, George Gallo, and I have been through that even as recently as a few TV seasons ago, where we had this idea and George pitched it and two of the networks loved it, and one of them bought it right away and paid George and his partner Josh to write the script, and it sat, and we waited to see if it would get approved and get approved and get approved and on and on and on. And like most things don't get done at that time. And then you're either stuck because they paid for stuff that they don't want to let go of, or like in our case, we part ways and walk away and we go try and arrange something else with somebody else. So all of that is a way of saying the advantage, at least for a writer, is that you can go ahead and write.
Mm-hmm.
If you have in your mind and your vision what you want your story to be, script wise, write it. Don't depend on going in and being able to pitch it to somebody and having them pay you to write it.
Right.
It's unlikely to happen. You know?
And it really gets tricky, I think, because like you said, if they pay you for the idea, they can take that idea and have somebody else rewrite it totally different than what you may have
written.
Because they just paid you for the idea, maybe the characters. Assuming that they take the whole package. In that case, I mean, I would, unless you know what you're doing, you could very easily sign away your characters to them.
Listen, the only time it's your idea is when you first, it's your idea, right?
Right.
As soon as you walk in the door and offer it to somebody else, if they take it on a basis that you accept, then it's not yours anymore. Then it's whoever putting up the money gets to speak, right?
Right.
Now, if you feel so confident in yourself that you're the one who wants to write it, that you've gotten in the door to pitch the idea, and they love the idea, and they say, but yeah, no, but we really want Aaron Sorkin to write it, you know, not you, sorry, you know, you have the ability to say, well, then I'm not selling you the idea. I'm right. only selling you the idea. And that can certainly be worth doing or trying, depending on their excitement over the idea. That's assuming, of course, you've been able to get in a door.
Right.
Yeah, and right. And do it. And they might just as likely say, okay, my friend, go ahead and write it. Then come back.
Yeah.
Let me see what you've done.
Yeah. Don't like it. Do it again.
Without giving you the big check to go ahead and do it.
Oh, okay. Well, that was.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They might say, sure. All right. You want to see what you do? Okay. Go do it. And then show it to me.
Right. Right. So this media company that, like I said, will remain nameless and that I was working with. I mean, they present this whole idea like, you know, you're going to be working hand in hand with producers, and some of them are pretty well-known producers. I mean, I'm not talking like Spike Lee or, you know, anybody like that, but people who have some credit to their name and have produced in a series on TV or a series for Netflix or something like that. So you can look them up in IMDb and you say, wow, you know, these guys are all in there. And of course, with having a background of talking with you and talking with George, I had a little bit probably more information at my fingertips than a number of people who were like signing up right away. And I mean, I'm talking a pretty good share of money, like $500 to these people.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah.
And they're promising that you'll be able to pitch your idea to this particular producer. So they met their, if you will, you know, the means to keep the money that you give them. Because they will set up a time where you're going to produce, where you're going to pitch to a producer. Whether or not that producer likes the idea and accepts it is not part of the part of the bargain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
of course not. Right,
no, right, because you know, hey, they can make money elsewhere. And of course, I think that your $500 is basically going to that producer to listen to you for 20 minutes. And I think there's a big hook here of, yeah, that's a great idea, but I don't like the way that you've written it. And then you end up in that development hell and, mm-hmm. you know, with this group. And like I said, he was saying, you know, oh, we've got four or five projects going. And it would, you know, when you look at the number of scripts that they said they have and you divide that by the number that are in development, it's like 0.008 something percent.
Right. Right.
And probably even a smaller number than that. So mm-hmm. I was sitting there asking questions, mind you, like things like, okay, so I do my pitch, they like the idea, and I want some guidance while I'm writing the script because I do have some script writing experience. But, you know, that 20 minutes that I need in direction on my script, am I paying another $500 to talk to that producer then? And the answer was yes. So, you know, it's like, I was like, okay, well, this doesn't sound as good as what you were making it sound like. So, so it's just kind of like you were saying, there's the ability of us writers to write a script, and there's nothing stopping us from doing it, and there's nothing stopping us from quote unquote, producing our own YouTube video or movie of what we've written. I mean, we could do that. It's all our money. You know, it comes down to who's going to pay for what, right?
Yes, that's, you know, sort of what I was saying before, hinting at that directing is a middle ground, because if you're a beginning director these days, unlike old days, you can pick up a video camera or your cell phone and go out and shoot something.
Right.
And you can show somebody how you can direct.
Yeah, there's been a couple of films, I think, that have been using their iPhones or something. That's
yes, absolutely. Yeah. I have a friend who worked with me on a project, actually co-wrote a script with me, who's a professor at NYU Film School, and he teaches a course in cell phone filmmaking. He actually started a festival, a cell phone film festival in India.
Right.
That's now an annual thing going on in India. So, yeah, so that ability is, I can just take my camera of whatever sort, and I can go out and I can shoot something, and I can have a little piece of finished product that I've edited myself on my Mac, and there you go.
Right.
You go back 40, 50 years, obviously didn't exist. So that's an advantage too.
Right.
Right. From the writing standpoint, I never totally trusted any of those situations that you were talking about where people are asking you to pay. There are festivals that go on every year, LA in particular, New York, of course, where they will try and development people. Executives from the production companies to come and listen to pitches.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my own sense is those people are probably being paid by the festival to come and sit there and listen.
Right.
So it's a little extra money in their pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the odds of, to me, of walking in a door, pitching something to somebody over a table for 5 minutes, having them say, boy, that's the greatest thing I ever heard. Here's $100,000 for you to go write it, and I want to buy it. I wouldn't put any big bets on that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't pay $500 for that. And I've been on the other side of it too. I've been invited to come and listen to these festivals to listen to pitches, which I wasn't really anxious to do either. You know, I've sat on a panel or two, you know, to talk about things, but to sit there and listen to pitches. You know, I don't want to listen to stuff, you know, when I'm not really probably going to be able to make it happen for people.
Yeah.
You know, it's just it's not the right kind of thing. You know, if I get into any kind of project and I've heard of an idea somewhere, or somebody's come to me with an idea, if it's something I really want to pursue and I know it's going to take a long time pursuing it and a lot of this and that, I'm going to be very honest with people up front and say, you know, most things don't happen. We will give it every shot. You know, this is how it's gonna go, or we're gonna try and make it go. And if lightning strikes, hey, maybe we'll be lucky. But at least we're starting out with a good idea. If somebody thinks it's worth $500 to go to a pitch festival and just get feedback on their idea, you know, more power to you. Only you can determine, you know, whether you think that's $500 or not, to see what, if people say, oh, that sounds like a great idea to me, why don't you write it? You know, which is likely the answer you'd get out of it. I would encourage people always to get feedback either on their idea initially, to see if there's something you would have to approach a little differently when you get into writing, or go ahead and write the thing and have people that you respect read it. And that's one area that I think is very legitimate, is script consultants. There are very good script consultants out there, particularly in LA, who have experience in various phases of the industry, either as development people or scriptwriters themselves or whatever, who admittedly, this is the way they make extra cash. They do consulting for people. But there are a lot of very good ones there that are very good to help with script structure, with character development, to guide you of what a script might be missing, what it needs, and can be very useful. That is worth paying for, I think, as far as I'm concerned. And there are a small number of cases, even with them, where they might say to you, listen, if I love what you end up with, you and I together consulting with you, I have a few contacts I might be willing to try and send it to.
Okay.
Because if they're out in LA and they're operating in the business, they may know a few people.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So that could lead to something. But just the consulting itself to get the knowledge of the form and the structure is worth it. What I would not pay for, or at least for me, and I wouldn't necessarily suggest for anybody else, is too much money on festivals. And I certainly would not pay for any agent who asked me to pay to have them read the script.
Yep.
And that's rampant too.
Yeah.
And has been forever. They will say, sure, I'll read your script. Give me $300.
Right.
I wouldn't do that. And I wouldn't think a good legitimate agent would do that. Probably wouldn't be that main agent who read it anyway. They would give it to some assistant, some reader and whatnot. And the chances of that leading to something. Listen, we know the odds of anything happening anyway.
Right.
So the question becomes, is, all right, now I've sat down for 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, a year, whatever it is, and I've got a script that I feel pretty good about.
Mm-hmm.
What in the world do you do with it if you don't have the contacts and what to do?
Right.
Well, the odds of you taking that script and sending it into a studio or a network or Netflix or Amazon, come on. So where are you left with? Of course, you're left with agents and you're left with production companies,
right?
Primarily.
Yep.
And I would say the more likely possibility at any chance of success would lie on the production company side, probably even more than agents who are worth their salt. But that can be possible too. Now, how do you go about doing that? Well, you've got some advantages now that you didn't used to have either. You've got social media.
Mm-hmm.
You've got, LinkedIn, say, being one prospect. And I guess all I'm suggesting there is if you can make a connection, and I don't even mean, if you look up in an agency or a production company, don't look for the owner of the production company, the partner, the producer who used to run Disney, or the agent who's a partner in CAA. They're not going to pay attention. But you might be able to get an email through or a LinkedIn message to an assistant in the company, somebody who's an assistant to the agent. Maybe you can strike up a little conversation, pique some interest. And if you're able to do that and say, Sally, would you be willing to do me a giant favor and take a look at my script? And maybe you could advise me,
right,
within the larger world that you're in. Could happen, yeah.
I got a story on that just.
Yeah, because everybody working in the business, particularly at the assistant level or junior agent level or lower creative executive at a production company, they're looking to find a diamond in the rough.
Mm-hmm.
And run into the boss and say, look what I've got for you. This thing is fabulous.
Right.
Yep. Well, that reflects well on them.
Yep.
So it's an avenue to try.
Right.
We're all going to be struggling to look for things to try.
Right.
And that, I think, is one way that's sort of available. There's more ways to try and connect with people these days, of course, than there used to be.
Yeah, it's interesting because the story that I can relate to you and you'll probably laugh at is the fact that this happened back in like 1980, 81, 82, somewhere in there. And I had sent my resume out to Industrial Light and Magic. And I basically wanted to work on the next Indiana Jones movie. And so I sent it out to Lucasfilm. I sent it out to ILM. I was like, just get me a job. I'm going to get to California. Well, they naturally sent a note back and said that my file was in the files with everybody else. So I'm
That's
entering this
right.
huge room of file cabinets at that time. You didn't send them
Right.
in electronically then. And but there's this number and this name of this woman's name, Bobby. Okay. And then her full name underneath it and a telephone number. I called that woman every week after work on Friday when I was so depressed after testing toilet paper for a week. And I was like, okay, Bobby, this is Linda. I'm just checking to see if I got on his desk yet, and all that kind of, and I filled up a rapport with her. And then I think it was probably 6 months or 7 months, something like that, after I had actually sent it in, and they actually, I guess, got the green light, if you will, if you want to call it that, for making the movie. I called Bobby on the phone and I said, hey, Bobby, this is Linda. I said, I know it's probably not out of the filing cabinet yet, but I just thought I'd call and say hi and see how you're doing. And she started laughing and I said, what are you laughing at? She goes, your file is on Howard Kazanjian's desk right now. And I went, really? And she's like, yeah. And I'm like, oh, I'm gonna go out and drink. This is great. So she says, call me back on Monday or Tuesday. And I said, okay. So I hung up the phone, called him back on Monday and Tuesday. I actually talked with Howard. He probably would never remember me, but said that if I would make it out to California, he would make me a gopher, basically. Well, I had a job at Procter and Gamble that was playing pretty good money versus going out and maybe not getting paid as a gopher. So, there wasn't any real, I didn't have experience. And he told me that right off the bat. He says, first of all, Linda, love your drive, no experience. I can't hire you basically for a paying job. And so, but I mean, it's a memory that I have. I tried hard. I
Well,
got on
listen,
his
see,
desk.
you made the lower level connection.
Right.
You made a connection with somebody and it led somewhere. It
Yeah.
led to the boss.
Yeah.
And if you and if your situation was a little different at the time,
Exactly.
say you were young and just totally passionate about getting into the movie business, come hell or high water,
Right. And
you'd have
male.
picked up and you would work for nothing just to get in the door
Yeah, and a
out
male, because it was a lot different in 1980 than it is today
there.
out there for females.
It
So
was right.
we were sitting there, I'm looking at all the, I did a pros and cons and went through the whole discussion of is this right for me to do? And it was a little scary. I mean, I was probably
Oh,
20
no
years
question.
old, I was
No
20 years
question.
old. So do I regret not doing it? No. I mean, I've done things the way that I wanted to do, but it just was a great story that flew right into make a contact with somebody out there, not the big names, the smaller
Right.
names.
It can lead to somewhere. That's
Yeah.
right. That's right. So it's worth a try, you know?
Now everybody out there is saying, why didn't you go?
And then, of course, if you remember, I think the last time we talked a bit about sort of a philosophy I have that if there's any way that you can think of to make the business come to you
Right.
rather than you banging on their door,
Right.
it's, you know, a universe worth of difference. And how do you do that? I think I, you know, back when we talked, I put it in terms of make yourself findable, you know, any way you can think of. And, you know, whether that's through social media somehow, on this other story that George Gallo and I have been working on for some time now, that ended up with NBC for that attempt. And, you know, now we hope this year, even more than that. I figured out a way after a certain amount of time to get the story, which was a true story, covered on First Court TV and then 60 Minutes. Well, once it was on 60 Minutes, people came calling.
Right.
Well, you can imagine how quite a different conversation it is if you're banging on somebody's door or sending emails saying, I have this great story. Won't you look at it? And if they're calling you saying, I saw this thing You have it? Oh my God, can I have it, please?
Yeah.
You know, it's such a light year's worth of difference.
But think about it. I'm going to talk like real quickly to the writers out there. Just think about how many times you're sitting in a social situation and you say, I write novels, or I write plays, or I write scripts. How many times people go, oh, I have a story for you. And then they expect you to write it. And think about your feelings
right.
that you, right. you go through at that time when you're hearing it. Mm-hmm. And you're just like, write it yourself, you know? So
that's right.
So that feeling that you're having is no different than any producer hearing a pitch unwanted at the time or any story, right? I mean, it's right there, you know?
Yes. Listen, but it has happened. You know, this story that I keep referring to, this jewel thief story, great story that I got on 60 Minutes, and now hopefully George and I will still get going, was initially sent to me as an email. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 99%, of course, of the email pitches that I get, I'll read a line or two and, you know, and I'll feel bad because it doesn't strike me and, you know, whatever. But this one happened to be interesting to me. And his opening line was, my dad's got a pretty interesting story and he's ready to tell it.
Yep.
And it led to me saying, well, what's your dad's story? And led to phone calls and visits and right. all sorts of business and on and on and on and on from that. And ended up on 60 Minutes, you know, and still then we're fighting for years afterwards, you know, to get it actually in front of the cameras. But it has happened that yeah. I'll see something in an email, you know, and it will lead to something, or I'll see something somewhere else. I'll find something in a newspaper article or whatever.
Right.
So
the writers that are listening in, a piece of advice, because I'm sure we sound like, you know, Debbie Downer over here going, oh, it'll never get produced. It'll never get made. Just keep writing. Make yourself
absolutely. Absolutely. Listen, you're creating magic. When you write something, you're creating something that wasn't there before.
Yes.
And you're creating a bit of magic. And
build your platform.
If you believe in it, mm-hmm. you have to get it to a point where you love it. Not, you know,
even
well, I think,
the only
this is, I think this is what they're looking for. You know, that guy, you have to love it. Unless you love it, no one else is going to love it either.
Yep.
You know, but you get it to that point, you've created something, and all more power to you.
Right.
You've created something in the universe, you know, whether it goes any further or it doesn't.
Yeah. I mean,
there
are so many other opportunities that are available for authors, and you've actually have gone down somewhat a similar road. I have one Audible book out there. You've got one in the process of being mm-hmm. created. So mm-hmm. that avenue will also start to pull in more fans of your work. So it's not like you can't walk in with no platform whatsoever, no one knowing or hearing the story or reading it, and expect someone in Hollywood to say, oh, yeah, let's go make this into a movie because, you know, there's one person who loves it.
Right. right.
You got to get I mean, the reason why Outlander became Outlander was because that was a best-selling book, and there was a audience built in that was going to go see or watch that series. It's the same mm-hmm. thing, you know. If you're very niche in what you're doing, it's going to be harder. But there are some production companies that do look at very niche films. Just don't expect to be a millionaire walking out from that. And, you know, I assume that a producer is going to turn around and say, well, you need to put up some equity, too, besides just the script, I'm assuming. Is that true?
Well, no, not necessarily. Okay. I mean, that depends on what, you know, what. Part of the media you're trying to deal with.
Okay.
You know, if you're making a show for a studio, no money's coming from you. It's coming from the studio, right. And they're, you know, giant financial partners and hedge funds or banks or whatever. If you're going into the broadcast networks, it's their money. It's not yours. Okay. If you're going to Amazon or Netflix or Disney Plus or Apple, their money. Okay. It's not yours. The only place you might get into where, you know, do you have any equity to put into this is independent film.
Yeah.
Which these days, it's sort of sorry to say, there's less of a universe out there for than there were at various other times. On the other side of that scale is that there is now Amazon and Netflix and Disney and Apple and Peacock and, you know, every place else just hungry for content.
Right.
And not just series content, also movie content. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what might be called a hybrid of a TV movie and a feature, you know, go, what do you call The Irishman now? Netflix was the only one to put up $150 million to make it.
Yeah.
You know, that's a pretty big television movie. Obviously, they put it in theaters for a few months, part of the bargain, but it was put up by a network. So
it is kind of an interesting dynamic because remaining quiet on some things, like I'm not going to name names or whatever, but I've heard a couple times, or I've seen or read a couple times, where they'll go ahead and make the film. And I think this is probably the influence of like Netflix and Amazon or whatever, without really going to figure out where they want to distribute it or how they want to distribute it. You know, are they going to go just in theaters and then a year later into?
Yes, it's for the big streaming services, it's an evolving world.
Yeah.
They don't really know yet. Their initial instincts, Netflix and Amazon say at the top of the list, was just to show it on their services.
Right. Yeah. So it's kind of interesting because I would think that this is the old project manager coming out from Procter & Gamble. But, you know, I would always think that you would, if you're going to invest a lot of money, to me, $1 million is a lot of money. But if you go and invest $150 million, you're going to know what you or how you want to distribute it at that point. But I'm finding more and more that they just kind of don't do that. Are they letting things like focus groups, and you may not know this, Dick, but you may, I don't know. But
I don't know that for sure. And I'm sure they do have that going on. When you're certainly probably doing focus groups on creative content and distribution strategies and all sorts of things. I think Netflix and Amazon both know that, not allowing their films to be in theaters has not been popular in Hollywood, and certainly not popular among the theater owner community.
Right.
So there were theater chains that wouldn't show The Irishman because Netflix wouldn't give them the theatrical window and protection for whatever, 4 months, 6 months, whatever that they're used to getting. So that's a very evolving world. But of course, the streamers want to win Oscars too. Mm-hmm. And they know in order to do that, they got to play for a week in the theater in LA before the end of the year.
So, right.
And that's, they are allowing that stuff to happen, certainly on their larger projects.
Right. And I was saying that's the key. You may get 10 big cities, New York, Chicago, LA, San Francisco, Seattle, Miami, you know, someplace else, somewhere in the middle, Philadelphia, where the audiences they know are bigger. So they can release in those 10 cities for the week. That puts them in front of getting an Oscar or up for some kind of award, and then pull it down and put it on their streaming services. The interesting number to me would be how much money they make by not going into the theater and having a streaming service only. Like, do they make more money? That, because I mean, honestly, I'm not paying $17.99 to watch this on my big screen.
Well, that is their dilemma. There's no question. And for them to open it theatrically, that's a big commitment in prints and advertising, mm-hmm. promotion, you know. And if they spend, of course, $150 million on a movie, they're going to want to spend it. They want to spend another $50 million or more, you know, on the prints and ads and promotion and everything else. But even as far back as the days of TV, you know, TV networks showing theatrical films after the theatrical release, more so in the DVD era, particularly in the DVD era, theatrical release for most films became a loss leader. And the studios would know that going in. Mm-hmm. They were going to go lose money in the theater overall, even if you read things that they grossed $100 million. And, you know, because remember, 50% of that goes right to the theater owners,
right,
you know, on a sliding scale, depending on how long they're in the theater. Mm-hmm. And the costs of their again, they're making their prints to send to theaters. Now they do it electronically, and advertising, humongous advertising and promotion costs and whatnot, that for most movies, they're not going to make money doing just that. Mm-hmm. But doing that creates the awareness among the public, and they gather, they hope, a bevy of good reviews and good Rotten Tomato scores and whatnot, and that will then create the value in those days to put on DVD, now to stream it, you know, and any other use they can think of. So it's that blitz. Mm-hmm. Using the theatrical release and all the attendant advertising and promotion around it to create the awareness that's going to make everybody go and stream it. Because if they went right to the streaming, who's going to know about it other than their own, basically their own email promotions and online promotions and whatnot, you know, because there's a certain amount of reviewers that won't pay attention to it if it hasn't had a theatrical release, you know.
So that's a good thing.
So, well, maybe so, yes. But it's all about, you know, or the old Hollywood adage, no, I don't care what you say about me, just spell my name right.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, just get me in the paper one way or the other to create awareness. Because you got to create, you know, like we said before, you got to be findable. Yep. Same thing for a movie.
Yep.
The audience has to know you're there.
Right.
Same for a movie, book. Anything else?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a whole thing with my blind series, the books that I write. You know, I would love to see that as a series or something like that, but you know, very, 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 very small chance of that happening. And I know some people, so hint, hint. No, I'm kidding. But yeah, but it's one of these things where you know, I have fun writing the books. I have fun trying to figure out if I were going to do this as a series, how would I do it? I think I've written two scripts that take two different point of views. Most of it has been written in my head, but you know, trying to get that into paper, I'm still trying to figure out what angle I would take this from to do it. So that's there. And then I've always had the thought of maybe if I could talk to some friends who might want to have fun acting some stuff out, because I certainly don't have the money to pay them, you know, that we just do a podcast where we act out the characters. So I had a mm-hmm. number of different ideas of doing it some different ways that would make quote unquote my dreams come true, you know, hearing it mm-hmm. made as a production.
Yeah.
You know, and if it did happen to garner a lot of interest, you know, millions of listeners on a podcast or something, you're going to end up catching somebody's eye some way, somewhere down the road, whether it's an independent or whether it's going to be one of the studios or something. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's like, as much as we're saying how hard it is to do this, you have to understand it's also hard work for you to get that cast ensemble together, to have them read on a podcast. I mean, it takes a lot of work and a lot of commitment to get that done. It's mm-hmm. just basically your sweat equity that you're putting into it mm-hmm. versus trying to pitch to producers or studios or broadcast.
And as you say, you're creating something.
Right.
And that's that number one, you've created right. and it's there, which is great in itself. And number two, it's discoverable. It's mm-hmm. findable.
Right.
By people who are looking for projects to get involved in.
Right. So it's, you know, there, as much as we talk about this particular way to get to Hollywood, there are other ways that you can make yourself happy creating. And that's what this is basically, you know, the show is all things creative. So, you know, we're not saying don't go out and do that.
No, do it.
Do it.
Do it all.
It was saying right. The exact opposite, because that could lead to the opportunity of you getting that big break later on. And right. By the time, I guarantee you, by the time you are tired of rewriting and writing scripts, you know, or doing the podcast or searching for people to be the characters or whatever, I mean, I probably have gotten, it's like any other painting I do. And I get to the point where I'm tired of working on the painting, I call it done. And it's the same kind of thing. I think at some point in time, you get tired of banging your head against the wall, and then all of a sudden some other door opens, right?
If lightning strikes, yeah. That's right. That's
yeah.
Right.
So.
But, well, you know, you have to have the passion for it, as I always tell people, you know, particularly when people come out of school and say, how do I get in this business? And my first question will be, number one, do you have a passion that you must do some part of this business?
Right.
And then if the answer is yes, is which part of this business? You know, because there's two big halves of it. There are the people who create product, mm-hmm. you know, writers, directors, actors, makeup people, grips, electricians, you know, on truck drivers. I like to tell younger people too, whatever you like to do in life, you can do it in the movies.
Right.
Because there's some place on the crew for you that's needed in the movies. There's 50 or more different disciplines going on a movie crew. And there's the other whole side of the business, which are, you know, agents and lawyers and studio executives and development people and the people who love making deals more than they love making products.
Right.
Say one is more valid than the other. They're both necessary. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, both halves of the business know very little about the other half.
Right.
About what they do. And but if you have a passion for any part of that, then go for it. Just do it. Do what you can do and give people the opportunity to find you.
Okay. So let's jump up to we've written the scripts, it's gotten accepted, we've gotten quote unquote green lighted in development. So now we're gonna go out and we're gonna find the cast and we're gonna go get the money to create something. I mean, it can still fail at that point, right? It could get to the point.
Well, it depends where and what you're talking about. Okay. When you say it's green lighted and we're going to go find the money, well, if we is the writer, you're not going out to find the crew and the director and everybody else unless you've sold yourself as a producer also, you know, or you're a showrunner on a TV series. Once you're if you're talking about the writers primarily, once you've sold the thing to the production company, the network, the studio, whatever, your role is most likely going to be over unless they ask you to do any other rewrites along the way.
Or be a consultant? Can you be a...
Probably not as the writer.
Okay.
In certain cases, depending on your stature and on the director who's involved, maybe they'll want you around and want your input. Mm-hmm. During production,
but probably not.
But just as likely not.
Yeah,
it's just as likely true, and certainly you're not going to be the one, you know, putting the pieces together,
right?
That go into making the movie. But if by we means you're a producer, also you've written the script, you bought the script, you brought along the script, and you've gotten a green light, as you say, from the studio or the network or whatever, means they've said, okay, I'm ready to turn money over to you to make this. Mm-hmm. You know, what's your schedule? What's your budget? Who's in it? You know, you're not probably not going to get the green light until all those things are in place to their satisfaction.
Okay.
Then it becomes the production process.
Okay.
And the production process is basically pre-production, production, post-production.
Right.
And, you know, we can talk about any of that you want to. Okay. But then, you know, if you're starting out as the writer, pretty much that's going to go on probably without you largely.
Right. Right.
Unless what you've done is resulting in a TV series and, you know, they want to keep you in the writer's room or, you know, or that kind of thing, which can certainly happen too.
Right.
If lightning strikes.
But you have to also be very careful with that, because if you're constantly saying, no, that's not the way my character is supposed to be, they may not want you around. So,
no question.
Yeah.
That's generally why
it's
most,
a cut and dry.
Most directors, producers don't want you around.
Right.
Because they say, thank you very much. You did a wonderful job. You know, we'll see you at the screening afterwards.
Yeah. So if a writer is not willing to sell their idea and or their characters and allow them to be developed without their say, then maybe you just want to stay writing your characters all the time and not
that's right
not
there you go so, this is not the theater,
right?
You know, where you can't change a word without the writer's consent.
Yep.
This is not movies and television don't work that way.
Yeah. So I guess then, is it the producer that basically gives something the green light in development?
Well, it's the money source.
It's the money source. Okay.
Because what everybody's heading towards is who's going to put up the money to pay and turn the cameras on.
Okay.
You know, so whether it be the studio or the network. Or the independent, you know, hedge fund guy who's willing to say, sure, I'll give you $2 million to go make a little movie. Right. It's getting the money to getting down to brass tacks, you know, and sure, it's part of creative decision. Is this project ready to be made? Am I Paramount or Amazon or whoever satisfied that this is ready and that I'm willing to put up 5 million, 10 million, 20 million, 50 million to make it? That's the green light.
Yeah. And that
money, go ahead and set up your bank account, you know, start hiring your crew. On this date, we'll give you so much money and show me your cash flow sheets and on and on and on and on into production.
Right. And it's no different than any other big business in that you have accountants that take care of all of that spending and how much money. And so it's not like, well, here's $50 million, go make the movie.
Well, yes, they have to like the money source, whether it be, again, studio, network, whatever, is going to want to trust somebody.
Right.
Usually it's going to be the producer, you know, that they're going to trust to say, I'm going to put this money in your hands. Mm-hmm. Of course, they're going to have their own executives on the phone with you every day or every other day. You know, what's going on? How's it going? Let us see the dailies, you know, blah, 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 blah. And they're going to be nervous wrecks the entire time until something gets done. But they're going to trust that producer. Likely as not, they're going to trust that director that they've agreed to or that they've convinced to do it. Or they have their fingers crossed if they're relatively new. To put that money in their hands. But yes, then it's a whole process. It's not, here you go, here's a suitcase full of $50 million, go spend as you will.
Right.
You know, then it involves cash flow spreadsheets and bank accounts and guarantees and, you know, all sorts of things. Yeah.
Right. And I'm sure, do they look at things like return on investment? And I'm assuming that they have some type of financial...
Their computer models,
yeah,
and things, you know, big independent companies have started up trying to claim, you know, that they can put into computers all the formulas and they can project box office down to the dollar based on who's in it, who's this and who. And of course, you know, they largely go broke almost every time.
Right.
Because. You know, these things you can try and project things on past performance, which is why you like your director to have a track record. You like your stars to have a track record, you know, and if you can sit there and say, you know, Brad Pitt's movies have made $5 billion. So don't blame me if it doesn't work. I got Brad Pitt, you know, That's kind of all the projection they need. Yes, I'm sure internally they've got all sorts of little internal projections, and God knows what goes on at the streamers at Netflix and Amazon, because they won't tell anybody
right
what they do in their back rooms and how they figure things out. But it's no science. It's they might just say, you know, hey, listen, this is our $200 billion pot to deal with this year,
right.
You know, so we can make so many series, we can make so many movies, we can do so many this and so many that, and you know, we can make so many movies at this level and that level, and you know, this is their discussions that I'm sure they go on internally yeah. all the time. Yeah. Unlike, say, older days, I got my start very much so in making old time television movies. In the 70s and 80s, when NBC and CBS and ABC and Fox wasn't even started yet as a network, each of those networks had a movie, two movie nights a week, CBS Tuesday night movies, the NBC Sunday night movie. And each of them made about 25, at least, original television movies a year.
Yeah,
you're talking and about that was a great business. And I made a whole number of those movies for your old stomping grounds, Procter & Gamble, and General Foods. That's how I got my start, doing it for advertisers of one of the big ad agencies in New York. And then we became our own production company, doing them either for those clients or directly for the networks, and then off on my own. But in those days, when it came to that, when it came to a television movie, we knew in those days that we were spending, give or take, $2 million, $2.5 million, you know, on a movie,
right?
Because that's what the market could bear. Because there were 12 minutes an hour of commercials,
yep,
on the network, right? So a two hour block, the CBS Tuesday night movie, say, it was going to have, you know, 24 minutes of commercials. They were worth so much, blah, 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 blah. And if you were making it directly for the network, they knew that they wanted to pay you $2.5 million, and that's it. Don't come and ask me for any more money.
Right.
You know, if you need more money, go sell it to Japan. You know, that kind of thing. And even when we started making our own, which we did for a Procter & Gamble, for a General Foods, we knew based on the value of what they normally paid for all the commercials that they filled up in a two-hour block of time,
mm-hmm.
you know, what they could afford to put up to make a program. And it was so cut and dry, I would say, so sort of structurally predetermined, that you knew that if you had that kind of money to make on a television movie, because that's what the commercials could bear in a two-hour time period on the networks, that then, depending on how much you had to pay for your stars and director and writers and what they call above-the-line costs, mm-hmm. and what you had to spend on your crew and cameras and equipment and trucks and everything else, what they call below-the-line, mm-hmm. And this is how many days you could shoot for. You couldn't shoot for 50 days, you know. You could shoot, if you were lucky, maybe 22, 23 days. In some cases, as few as 18 days, if you were spending more on your actor, on your stars. And it became a very structured thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it made the production much more controlled in a way, you know, much more structured on a regular basis. Feature films, on the other hand, for the theater, sky's the limit. You don't know what, if you film an extra 3 days, are those sequences that you film in those extra 3 days going to make the movie worth another $20 million in box office?
Mm-hmm.
You don't know that.
Right.
There's no way to project that. You just, everybody's going on their collective experience and instinct.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So, you know, it became a funny thing that we used to say to each other, like the production manager and me and, you know, people, when you're talking in the independent marketplace, they say, well, what's your movie going to cost? And my answer would be, how much money have you got? Because I can take the same script and the same story, mm-hmm. and I can make it for $5 million if you've got it. I could make it for $10 million and pay bigger stars more money. I could shoot twice the amount of time. Or if you tell me, listen, I only got $1.5 million, take it or leave it, I can make the movie for that. I can do it. I'm going to shoot fewer days, pay everybody less, yep. you know, and hustle, and we can do it. So it didn't even, it wasn't even a matter of, here's this script, budget it out, this is what it costs. It's also an old saying that a movie, you know, a script costs what it costs because that's what's on the page.
Right.
But not necessarily so.
Yeah.
You can control lots of things like right. how big the crews, how many days shooting,
how
much do you pay the stars, how many extras do you have, you know, yeah, how many teams for drivers. There's a lot of things that can be controlled. So it's much more very, very different than the TV movie structure. Yeah. You know, but now we're in a whole brand new world of outlets, particularly the Netflixes and Amazons and Apples and Disneys of the world, paying outrageous amounts of money to people, and creating a whole new paradigm and whole new structure for how things are done.
Yeah, this
and
is
everybody's trying to figure that out and whether it's at all sustainable.
Right.
To spend the kind of money that Apple and Netflix and Amazon and Disney are spending, you can't think it's sustainable because every one of us out there can't subscribe to every one of these services.
Right. But
you know,
it's kind of interesting when you think about Disney, though. I mean, how big Disney is, number one.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're kind of like on both sides of the sword, if you will. They have feature films that they're putting out in the theater. They have their own Disney Plus now, so they can stream everything, including Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you've got all these series that are coming off of Star Wars. And I'm a big Star Wars fan, but I'm like burnt out. It's like too much Star yeah. Wars out there for me anymore. But
yeah.
And I'm older, I guess, maybe if I was a kid, I'd love it. But they're kind of, maybe they're trying to figure out what the right formula is at this point, but they are doing a lot.
Well, they're all doing that. They're all trying to figure out what the right, you know, when I talk about Disney in this context, I'm talking about their new Disney Plus.
Okay.
Their streaming service.
Okay.
That's the competitor for Netflix and Amazon and such. Disney the studio obviously is the competitor of Universal and Paramount and
right.
all the other giants. But sure, Disney is a corporation.
Right.
So, well, they're vacuuming up everything else in town. Back the other studios look at them. They look at their you know, president of movie production, and they say you have the easiest job in the world. All you have to do is pick from Star Wars, Pixar, Marvel, Disney.
Right.
What else do you have to do?
Well, it's really kind of interesting, though, when you look at those films. Like I said, I was a big Star Wars fan. I've always been a Star Wars fan. My phone rings Star Wars themes. I mean, R2-D2 calls me. I mean, you know, so I am a big Star Wars fan. But at the same time, you know, I experience this burnout of so many things that somebody will come back and say, you're not a Star Wars fan because I am burnt out on it. But it's the same thing. It's like, you know, how many Marvel movies do we know that we're blowing up the world and they're saying
absolutely that, you know, absolutely thing. You know, and it is a shame. And for any of us that have some more original stories that right. we'd like to do,
yeah,
it's very frustrating because the theatrical movie business has become, you know, obviously boom or bust. Giant movie or nothing, virtually. Sure, there'll be every year the smaller group of independent movies, you know, Green Books of the world, and now a lot of those relatively smaller movies are going to the streamers to be produced. But as far as the big studio movies to get out in the theatrical marketplace, yes, they want they're spending such extraordinary amounts of money because they think they have to spend big money on big stars and big promotion in order to get the audience's attention, which is split a million ways these days, that they have to do that. And if they're going to spend that kind of money, they want pre-sale. Like you said, they want it in the minds of the public already. Mm-hmm. And that comes from doing sequels to other things and giant comic book characters and, you know, on and on and on of all these things we say.
What's the next special effect out there, you know? So
well, that's true. but it's the awareness in the public's mind that they want to buy going in, you know, if they can. So listen, that's what they found their business. You know, now things are going to be tested. Now not only do we have the streaming services and the Netflixes of the world, now we're going to get into the world of watching things primarily on your cell phone. Mm-hmm. You know, Quibi, the big company that's starting up in April, that's been going the last 2 or 2.5 years or so, that's got half of Hollywood doing short little series and broken up movies in no more than like 5 and 10 minute segments that you're going to watch on your cell phone. It's creating a whole new form, you know, and will it make it? Who knows? It's got some awfully great big people behind it in town. And you know, it's what they said about Netflix when Netflix decided to give 2 seasons worth to David Fincher and Kevin Spacey for House of Cards. $100 million for 2 seasons. Everybody thought either they're insane, Netflix, or they're brilliant. Turned out they were brilliant.
Yeah, it worked for me.
They changed the entire business.
Yeah,
I changed things around. It's amazing.
Yeah, I basically watched Netflix or started watching Netflix because of House of Cards. And and then, you know, now I'm hanging around and I'm watching all these other series, The Crown. We started watching, interestingly enough, that there's a series that Tom and I are watching now. I call it a series. It was a TV show that I was unaware of. I don't watch a lot of broadcast TV. It's called Blacklist with Bader. And we're loving it. And the reason why I love it is there's no commercials on Netflix. You know, it's like, because they're basically 42 minutes long. And so I knew it was a TV show as soon as, because everyone was like 42 or 43 minutes long. They weren't any longer than that. And it's really kind of because we can stream them right after the other to watch it. And there's no commercials. And, you know, okay, so I paid Netflix whatever the cost of Netflix is. And I basically paid to not watch commercials. So interesting that actually did flip that way. Of course, I guess I should have expected it because I can see Star Trek on there and, you know, a whole bunch of other different old shows. Andy Griffith Show, for example, your movie.
Andy Griffith Show.
I watched your movie the other night with Johnny Cash and Andy Griffith. And that had to be fun because, you know, we always think of Andy as the sheriff of Mayberry and he was the bad guy. Yeah. So
it's great that they flipped roles for that and they both love doing it that way. Johnny loved getting to play a sheriff and carry a gun and Andy loved playing the bad guy. If you've heard Andy interviewed, that for a few years after the Andy Griffith Show stopped in 1968, he couldn't get a job. Because everybody just thought of him as Andy of Mayberry. Mm-hmm. And until he started to play some bad guy roles, that got him rolling literally again, you know. And then after we did our movie, led to Matlock and whatnot. But yes, Andy and Andy Griffith Show was great to work with both those guys, obviously, number one. And it's led to still continuing interest all these years later. You know, they invite me back to Georgia to show the movie down there and at the Johnny Cash Museum in Nashville and at the Andy Griffith Museum in Andy's hometown in Mount Airy, North Carolina, near you now.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of fun to go see how fascinated and interested people still are in well, certainly the old series like that, and in a movie that I did quite a while ago.
Yeah, yeah.
With those two guys.
So happy.
Yeah, it's very gratifying.
Yeah, very happy for you. And so it's kind of interesting. Like I said, this whole Hollywood, I've kept you on talking now for about an hour and a half. So.
Oh my God.
So I do appreciate that. And on all of your knowledge, you know that I do appreciate and respect your work, and glad that
I appreciate that.
Yeah, that, you know, we become friends and
sure
we can talk, and looking forward to you introducing us to the Waffle House down here in Asheville.
Well, absolutely. Be my pleasure.
Yeah. And I could just all the foodie people in Asheville are going, no, not Waffle House. So.
Absolutely. Our road trips are bouncing from Waffle House to Cracker Barrel and back again. You know?
Oh, well, there you go. I think we got both down here, actually. So.
There you go. That's right.
So, yeah. So, I do appreciate everything that we've talked about, and your knowledge in this area, and being as honest as you are. And Dick is not kidding. I talked to him about Blind Series, and he was like, well, you know, we have to see if there's interest. And I, you know, he didn't say no, but he didn't say yes when we had our conversation. And I do appreciate his honesty. I'm still building the platform for that series anyway. So we're years and years and years and years away from that doing anything at this point, I think. But it's okay. Like we said, continue writing, continue creating, find people who share in your delight, just like Dick has done with the Andy Griffith and Johnny Cash murder at, I'm going to say the county wrong. Is it Cowet? Cowetta?
Cowita.
Cowita.
In the old days, they said Cayeta.
Okay.
Now these modern times, they're calling it Cowita.
Okay. So murder in Cowita.
Murder in Cowita County.
Yeah. And
murder
it's on,
Cowita County.
I think I watched it on Prime. So if you're interested, you can go out and watch that. It's really is interesting to see those roles reversed with Andy Griffith and Johnny Cash. You would expect Cash to be the bad guy, and he's not. He's really, really, really a good guy. And you will not even recognize June Carter Cash. I did not recognize her.
Really?
No, not at all. I mean, you know, maybe I was expecting Reese Witherspoon to walk across the stage or something, but I sat there and went, where is June? You know, so
I think I've told you in the past that was a battle with CBS to allow her to play that part.
Oh, wow.
Because it was, you know, an offbeat but critical role in the movie. Mm-hmm. And they felt if she doesn't have the acting chops for it, you know, that it's going to look silly. And they kept saying no.
No, she had
the acting. And June chops. Kept saying yes. And they kept saying no. And we were fighting for them. And luckily, like in many things, CBS trusted the director, Gary Nelson, enough that they said, well, okay. You know, and Gary said, I will have her look good. She will be good.
She was amazing.
She was great.
Yeah, she was fantastic.
Great.
And then, like,
then of course, when Andy heard that, he had to insist that his young girlfriend, soon to become his wife, would be in the movie.
Yeah, so. She was the witness, one of the witnesses.
Another whole story.
Yeah.
She was the wife of the victim.
The wife of the victim. That's right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So, and I think I pointed
out. And also did a nice job. Yeah.
Yes, she did. So good. And I guess if you have any questions for Dick around producing or anything like that, they can get a hold of you on Facebook. I know, because you're on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And LinkedIn, I guess, too.
Facebook, LinkedIn. Yeah. Twitter, whatever. Yeah.
So, again, thanks so much for your time, and thanks everybody for tuning in. We're going to go ahead and shut this episode, call it done, however, whatever you say to end the show, I guess you could say. There'll be a few more All Things Creative / Art Chats coming out. I'm talking with a number of folks, Jennifer McChristian, who's an artist. When George can catch his breath, he's promised me an episode. So we'll get George in here to talk, George Gallo, to talk about painting and writing and creative process and things like that. Probably get Carolyn Anderson again to come on. If you guys have any suggestions, I'm on Facebook, I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on MeWe, I'm on, it just sounds like I never get any work done of all these social networks I'm on, but drop me a line. You know, lfissler@lindafissler.com will get it right into my email box. You're welcome to do that as well. So thanks again, Dick, for talking with us. I do appreciate
it. Oh, my pleasure. Anytime.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun seeing you and talking with you. So from now on, we're out of here. So have a good week, everybody. Bye-bye.